Welcome to the Kalmouth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson, and welcome to Fidelity Month. This is the first week of Fidelity Month here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and many of you know that our state Senate declared or recognized June to be Fidelity Month. It passed by an overwhelming, as a majority vote, in favor of it. We've also seen other states recognize Fidelity Month for the month of June. Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders just acknowledged it the other day. Last year, the state of West Virginia acknowledged it. So at its core, Fidelity Month is defined by what it is for rather than what it's against. I know what you're thinking. June is known for something else. We all know it's been known as Pride Month for decades. But Fidelity Month is a proactive, forward-looking ideal of the things that make for healthy society. And behind it is the idea that there is a God who's the giver of our rights and our freedoms. It celebrates the idea of faithfulness within a marriage between spouses, and then of parents towards children. And then it encourages us to be grateful for our community and our country. Fidelity Month is outward looking. It is other center, where we value our neighbors and our community rather than looking inward towards ourselves. Dr. Robert George was the founder of Fidelity Month. He started it 4 years ago, and we had an opportunity to do an interview with him some time ago. And I hope you enjoy the time we spent with him. June is Fidelity Month, and it's a fairly recent effort to encourage Americans to recommit themselves to the ideas of fidelity to God, family, and country. I'm Richard Nelson, host of the Commonwealth Matters, and thank you for joining us. Also joining us to talk further is Dr. Robert P. George, who is the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and the director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University. He's a leading public intellectual, also known for his work on constitutional law, religious liberty, and natural law theory. Dr. George has served on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and the President's Council on Bioethics. But for our purposes today, he is the founder of Fidelity Month, an initiative promoting fidelity again to God, family, and country. Dr. George, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters.
My very great pleasure. Thank you, Richard, for having me on the show.
I'm going to start out with a survey done by the Wall Street Journal in 2023, and they found that the values of patriotism, religion, family, and community have declined significantly in the past 25 years. And I think this is what prompted you starting Fidelity Month. But consider some of these numbers. 38%, and this was taken, this survey poll was taken in 2023. They found that 38% of Americans believe that patriotism to be important. That was down from 70% just 25 years prior to that. 39% of Americans believe that religion to be important, down from 68%. 30% believe that having children are important, down from 59%. 27% believe that the value of community was important, down from 47%. At the same time, the value placed upon money grew by 12%. Yeah. Dr. George, any idea what has caused this shift in public opinion regarding these very important institutions?
Well, Richard, you're right that what inspired me to declare, by the authority vested in me by absolutely no one, June to be Fidelity Month, were those polling data, those survey results. They clearly show a decline in the belief of Americans in the importance of faithfulness to God, faithfulness to spouses and families, faithfulness to our country and to our communities. That startled me, and it really worried and worries me for this reason. Our nation is not a nation whose strength and unity is founded on blood and soil. Now, most nations of the world are nations whose strength and unity are founded on blood or soil or throne and altar. There's a common race, a common ethnicity, a common religious community or tradition or denomination, common cultural history. But we Americans are from many different races, ethnicities, religious traditions, cultural histories, cultural backgrounds. If we are to be united, if we're to have the strength that comes from unity, then we're going to have to found our strength and our unity on something other than blood and soil and throne and altar. Now, what is that something other, or what are the something others that we can found our strength and unity on? Historically, they've been really two things. Number one is a shared commitment to our nation's constitutional principles. Those articulated originally in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. But then secondly, shared beliefs in the importance of God, of family, and of community. Doesn't matter whether you're black or white, historically. Doesn't matter whether your ethnicity is Croatian or Italian or Japanese or from somewhere else. Doesn't matter whether you're Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Christian, from one of the Eastern religious backgrounds, your family history being in India or Japan or Southeast Asia. Americans were united across those lines of historical difference by a shared commitment to faith in God. After our national motto for everybody, not just for white, Christian, or anything else, is "In God We Trust." Allegiance to our country is to pledge allegiance to a nation under God. The language of under God coming from the great prayer Lincoln prayed, concluding his Gettysburg Address, praying that this nation under God will have a new birth of freedom and of the people by the people and for the people shall not perish from the earth. That was shared across races, religious traditions, ethnicities, cultural histories. Same with the belief in the importance of marriage and the family and the importance of fidelity in marriage. Didn't matter whether you were Asian heritage, European heritage, black, white, red, yellow. Didn't matter whether you were Latino. Didn't matter whether you're Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Christian, Eastern. Shared a belief in the family as the fundamental unit of society. And same for patriotism. If you look at the bloodshed for valiant men arms, which is in Normandy, Ojima, and then going back through all the wars, blood is not just white, it's not just black, not just European background, it's not just Catholic, just Protestant. It's the blood of Americans across the racial, ethnic, and religious differences. And that's because we were bound together, a shared belief in the importance of patriotism, of love of country, of giving back, of being contributing members, not only of our national community, but of our local communities as well. See those eroded now as these polling data from the Wall Street Journal show us. To worry, at least if you're me, you worry about, well, what's going to bind us together? What are going to be our sources of strength? Now, your specific question to me, Richard, was how did this happen? And I don't know the answer to that question. Certainly was accompanied by. So we have a correlation, and we don't know about causation because correlation is not necessarily causation. It's a correlation with the rise of secularism. And with the rise of a particular kind of ideology, which has accompanied our own increasing secularism, and that is ideology that's come to be known as expressive individualism. The term was coined by the great late University of California, Berkeley sociologist Robert Bella. It's been recalled to us by the great work of the evangelical scholar Carl Truman, who's written a wonderful book on this. The idea that what really matters is not God, it's not family, it's not community, it's me, me, me. A kind of selfish individualism. It's seeing the gratification of my own desires as what really matters in life. Americans historically have not believed that nonsense. But a lot of Americans today have come to believe it. We've refocused on me, myself, and I, and away from what's important beyond me, what's greater than me, what I can give my allegiance to and be willing to sacrifice for. God, family, country, community. And if we don't get those values back, Richard, if we don't restore our commitment to fidelity to God, to our spouses and families, to our country and communities, this republic will not survive. It just won't. Republics historically have failed. When they failed, they've collapsed into the worst forms of tyranny. If we want to preserve this one and prevent that from happening, we've got to recover our faith in fundamental values.
I agree. Dr. George, thank you for bringing up our founding political document. Of course, you talked about a lot there, but the idea of God is being central to our nation. You know, we're endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights. God is a fundamental part of our political fabric, and yet we have rejected that, if not verbally, at least implicitly, we're rejecting that idea. But I want to press into that fidelity to God. And it's no accident that you begin with that as the very first thing that we ought to be faithful to as a people, our Creator, who endows us with rights and gives us dignity and assigns value to each of us, incredible value and worth. So you begin with fidelity to God. But how do you reconcile this ideal across the religious spectrum? We live in a pluralistic nation.
Oh, yeah.
There are many religions that are practiced here. So is there some similarity between the religions that would promote fidelity to God in a religious, in a civic context where we benefit from this fidelity to God? Oh, and there's a lot religion? There.
Yeah, no, I get it. It's a great question. All right, let's ask ourselves, what is religion fundamentally about? Whether we're talking about the Christian religion to which you and I subscribe, the Jewish faith, the mother religion of Christianity, whether we're talking about Islam, whether we're talking about Buddhism, whether we're talking about Hinduism, we're talking about what is beyond the self. We're talking about the transcendent, that which transcends the immediate, the physical, the here and now. It's a belief that there is something beyond and something greater, things to which to aspire, standards beyond our own subjective desires and wishes and feelings that do set the standard for our belief and for our conduct and for our behavior. That's critical in a republic. Now, if you look at most nations of the world today and historically, if you ask people in your political system, where do fundamental rights come from? Where do the rights to life and liberty and pursuit of happiness, if you recognize them at all, where do fundamental rights come from? Who gave them to you? They will say the king, the parliament, the prime minister, the government. At some level, the government. It's the here and now, okay? We're different in America. We do not answer that question by saying our fundamental rights came to us from the government. We say our fundamental rights came to us from a transcendent source, from no merely human source of meaning and value. They come from the Creator. They come from a transcendent, loving, almighty God. And what that means, Richard, and here's the critical thing, is that for us as Americans, at least historically, as we've understood ourselves, as we've understood our political order, our civic order, because our rights and the duties that correspond to them do not come from any merely human power, not from a king, not from a president, not from a parliament, not from a Congress, not from a court, but come from a more than merely human power. No merely human power, no matter how great it is, may legitimately violate those rights or take those rights away. The government didn't give them. The government has no legitimate authority to take them away or in any way to violate or compromise them. That, to me, is the glory of this great experiment in ordered liberty and republican government that our founders, our great founding fathers, bequeathed to us, and which it's our duty to maintain and pass on to future generations. And that's why I declared June to be Fidelity Month. Because in my view, unless we rededicate ourselves to those principles, we will come to the belief that whatever rights and dignity we have as persons are simply gifts of the government, simply privileges handed to us by the government, that the government, under necessary conditions or under stress or in emergencies or whatever, can take away. That's not the America I want for my beautiful grandchildren. I'm sure it's not the America you want for your children and grandchildren. I think most Americans, if they thought about it, would say, that's not the future I want for my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. All right, that's not the future we want. If we want a future in which our strength and unity is to be preserved, then we're going to have to rededicate ourselves to fidelity to God, to our country and communities, and to our spouses and families.
Let's talk about fidelity to family and children in particular. And you said in a previous interview, you said being faithful to your children means being a mom or dad, being present for them. There's a lot of parental infidelity today that takes the form of allowing devices to entertain our children. And then you go on to say, you're not an extremist on this, you're not a Luddite, but if we are finding it convenient to allow our children to be entertained by games and devices so that we can free up our own time, we're doing a disservice. We're not being faithful to our children. I just paraphrase that last part of that statement. But it's difficult, Dr. George, to be a parent when it's not just the digital age that we're in. Our young people are getting a hold of smartphones. Look, they've got them in grade school now. They are on social media, Facebook and Instagram, and all their friends are on it. Is it going to take an act of legislation to reset the button as to, if you will, as to what's appropriate for children to further protect them? Because moms and dads are pushing against a cultural tide that is not healthy for our children, where they're not able to be present and be faithful in their parenting. What is it? That's, again, a lot there. But I want parents to have a vision, moms and dads to have a vision for how to protect their children, especially from the cultural harms that are coming their way.
Yes, well, government, and by this I don't mean necessarily or primarily national government, but state and especially local government and especially school boards and schools, public schools, I think do have a role to play, but that role is subsidiary. That role is secondary or even tertiary. The primary role has got to be played by parents and by those who assist parents, grandma and grandpa and auntie and uncle and pastor and teacher and librarian, all the people who are the immediate people in the lives of children, you know, not, you know, President Trump or President Obama or whoever it is, happens to be the president in Washington, D.C., not the governor. It's really primarily the responsibility of parents and families and those who assist parents and families immediately. What Edmund Burke called the little platoons of civil society, the private associations, the religious community, the pastors, the local community, the Little League, the Boy Scout, the non-governmental institutions that play such important roles in the formation of our young people's character and in the education of our young people. And a lot of that's going to have to be done by parents coordinating. We're going to form a pact among our parents to limit the access and maybe exclude it altogether for younger children to smart devices, which according to the research of my friend Jonathan Haidt, who I think has really done wonderful work on this. Jonathan is a very prominent, distinguished social psychologist at New York University. According to John's research, it's access to those devices that is playing a very important role in the mental health crisis, a negative role, contributing to the mental health crisis among our young people, which everybody in education at all levels knows about. If you mention the mental health crisis, and a person is a professor or a high school teacher or a middle school teacher, they're going to know exactly what you're talking about. The anxiety, the lack of a kind of interior peace, the concern that things aren't going right in my life that we see among our young people. So primary role for parents and civil society, secondary subsidiary role for government at all levels, especially the local governments and school boards and so forth. But this gives me an opportunity, Richard, to talk a bit more about the concept of fidelity, because I don't think it's completely well understood. Let me say a word that I hope will enrich our understanding of it. Let's think about the way the term is typically used to mean fidelity in marriage, fidelity to your husband or wife. Someone might think, well, I'm a faithful husband because I don't have extramarital affairs. Well, yeah, that's true. In that sense, you are a faithful husband, and that's a really important thing. You know, you're not faithful if you have extramarital affairs. But what I want to say about fidelity is that it goes beyond the negative, just not having extramarital affairs. A faithful spouse is a spouse, husband or wife, who sees his or her role toward his or her spouse as a vocation. Sees marriage as a vocation. What is vocation? What does that word mean? It means a calling to serve. Same thing it means when someone's called to be a priest or pastor, rabbi, minister. Marriage is the same. You're called to serve your spouse. And if you are blessed in your marriage with children, your children. So when we ask, am I being a faithful husband? It goes beyond, am I not having extramarital affairs? That's just the minimum. That doesn't really mean you're in the full, rich sense of faithful husband. Faithful husband is asking, how do I serve my spouse better? Am I there for her? Do I give her the support she needs when things are rough? Is she getting the kind of affirmation and love and commitment from me that I should be showing her? Same when it comes to children. Now, if you're having extramarital affairs, you're not only harming your spouse, you're also harming your children, whether they find out about them or not. But fidelity to your family, including your children, means more than just not having extramarital affairs. Are you there for your kids?
Yeah.
Or are you, and this is the point you quoted me making, or are you, instead of giving the kids your time and attention, are you handing them a device and say, here, this has got video games, or here, you can be on TikTok or Instagram and there's your social life? Are we exporting our parental obligations? Are we outsourcing our parental obligations to the devices? And if we are, stop it.
Yeah.
That's not right. That's not serving. That's not fulfilling your vocation as a father or a mother. So that's Richard, what I was trying to stress in the material that you quoted.
That's good. Dr. George, let's talk about communities. One of the things that the Commonwealth Policy Center did was we produced a model resolution for local governments, whether it's a city council or county level government, to celebrate Fidelity Month. And I think we made it available to you. I'm not sure if it's on your website. We have it available at the CPC website. This is one thing that mayors and judge executives here in Kentucky can do to promote this. So check out our website and get that resolution. But do you have any other recommendations as to how communities can participate in Fidelity Month?
Yes, and I so greatly appreciate, well, all the work that Commonwealth does. I appreciate all the great work you do. And of course, I especially appreciate your partnering with me and with others with whom I'm associated to recognize and promote Fidelity Month. I really am grateful, Richard, to everyone at Commonwealth for that.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Now, go to your website. I encourage everyone to go to the Commonwealth website, and not just because you can find good material there about Fidelity Month, but all the great work that the center is doing. But also, please go to our fidelitymonth.com website. And at fidelity.com, you will find lots of suggestions. And they're just suggestions for things that you, as an individual or a member of your church or of your community center or your community group, can do to recognize, to honor, to promote Fidelity Month, and most importantly, of course, the values for which Fidelity Month stands. Let me stress that Fidelity Month is a grassroots movement. This is not top-down. Nothing is dictated. Fidelity Month has no staff. We have a volunteer executive director. Of course, it's Christopher Parr, for whom I thank you because he came to us from your operation, and you trained him well, and he's doing a fantastic job on Fidelity Month and other projects on which he and I are working together. We have an executive director, but we really have no staff. We have no budget. This is not a top-down thing. So it's unlike most of these kinds of movements in the United States today, whether they're on the left or the right or center or not describable in any of those terms. And again, Fidelity Month is not on the left or right or center. I myself am a conservative. I myself have certain political views. But this is a positive movement that we would like to draw everybody into. All you have to do is share our, it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, no matter what you are, doesn't matter what your ethnic background is, certainly doesn't matter what your race is. You know, we want everybody to feel that they are part of Fidelity Month. If you agree that it's important to our strength and unity as a people, despite our cultural and historical differences, ethnic differences, religious differences, if you think it's important that we rebuild as a community faith in God, faith in within marriage and the family, fidelity to country and community. So there are suggestions there. We'd like everybody on your social media accounts to please use the Fidelity Month logo. It's free. You can just download it, put it right up on your social media accounts, whether you're on Facebook or X or Insta, whatever you're on, if you are on. There's a merch shop. We make no money on it. Things are sold at cost, which has our flags and other t-shirts, hats, things like that. Again, to promote fidelity, to get the idea in people's head. It's a way of spreading the good news, spreading the good word. You wear your shirt or your hat, you fly your flag or your banner. It's just a wonderful thing to do to help spread the word. Also, be in touch with your mayor. Be in touch with your city councilor. Be in touch with your state representative. They're in Kentucky or my home state of West Virginia or my current state of New Jersey, doesn't matter where. Be in touch with your legislator. Be in touch with your member of Congress. or one of your senators or both of your senators, and ask them to please support a kind of recognition by the political leadership of the Fidelity Month. Read something into the legislative record promoting a Fidelity Month. That too helps us to get the word out there. Hold an event at your church or at your community center, any organization that you're involved with where it would not be inappropriate. Please have a speaker. Have a speaker on the importance of patriotism. My goodness, when I was growing up, I know it was back in the Middle Ages, but when I was growing up, people weren't ashamed to be patriotic. I loved every Memorial Day watching my wonderful, beautiful father, World War II vet, fought in Normandy and Brittany, watching my father on Memorial Day marching in our little Mount Morris up in the Appalachian Mountains, little Mount Morris Memorial Day parade, and marching with the veterans, his fellow veterans. When I was young, there were still World War I veterans around. When my father was young and watching the parade, he could remember watching some very elderly Civil War veterans marching in the parade. But somehow it's become uncool or thought unsophisticated to be patriotic. I mean, enough with that nonsense. There's nothing uncool or unsophisticated about being patriotic. We are blessed to live in this wonderful land. Do we have faults? Yeah. All cultures, all societies, all polities do. Have we committed historical sins as a nation? Yes. And we're embarrassed about it. But are our principles sound? Absolutely. We have never had reason to feel shame when we have been faithful to our principles. Yeah. The only times we have reason to be ashamed is when we have been unfaithful to the principle that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. So we should be celebrating and proud to be celebrating our fundamental commitment to our nation, to patriotism. We should be patriots, just as we should be faithful to God and faithful to our spouses and families.
Dr. George, that is a well said, and unfortunately, we are out of time. I applaud you for launching Fidelity Month. I believe we're in the third year of it. But
we are,
this
yeah.
to remind Americans that we are blessed as a people, that we need to go back to first principles, becoming faithful to God, faithful to family and spouses, and faithful to our country and our communities. Again, I cannot thank you enough for taking the lead on this. Commonwealth Policy Center will be here to help you as we are able. And again, check out the Fidelity Month website. There are some great resources there. There's merchandise there, as Dr. George just mentioned. And Dr. George, again, thank you so much for joining us here on the Commonwealth Matters. May God bless you as you continue your good work on this.
Right back at you, my dear brother. Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.